Interview with Barry Goldsmith, February 5th, 2010, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. We can start by digging back pretty far into the past and talking a little bit about your education. Okay. I noticed you went to Wharton, and you got a degree in economics.
Right.
Which, a little unusual for someone who ends up in securities law. Tell me a little bit about that decision.
Well, I ended up going to Wharton, and I think the degree you get at Wharton is a BSE, so it's a Bachelor of Science in Economics. So
right.
Everyone who went to Wharton got
right.
that. So
right.
I can't say I took a lot of rigorous economics courses. I placed out of some and, you know, took things like Soviet economics. And,
but you had an interest in that subject, I guess.
Yes, economics, you know, business, markets interested me. My father, who passed away a few weeks ago, 94, worked for 44 years at the New York Times and then opened up his own brokerage firm. So up until the end, was watching CNBC and tracking his former client's portfolio. So, you know, there might be some genetic component here as well.
So you had some sense that this is what you were interested in and wanted to pursue.
Well, I thought more law, and we can jump ahead to law school.
Yeah, but, let's jump ahead to law school.
I went right to law school from Penn, and went to Georgetown Law School, and ended up taking a number of securities courses. Professor Bauman, who was at Georgetown, I for years, I don't know if I still am, I got the highest grade ever in his corporations class, then I took him for securities regulation, pass-fail. As worried that I was going to fail it, so I changed it to audit. So I had sort of an up and down career at Georgetown, but I enjoyed those courses, but ended up clerking for a federal district judge in Chicago for a year, which was fascinating, and then went to an antitrust litigation firm here in D.C. So I certainly didn't start out as a securities lawyer.
Okay. What was the antitrust litigation firm?
It was a boutique at that time, sort of a mid-sized firm of, we got as big as 60, which was, not tiny in those days.
Right,
it is now.
Right.
Bergson, B-E-R-G-S-O-N, Borkland, B-O-R-K-L-A-N-D,
okay.
Margolis, and Adler. Did primarily antitrust and then diversified into environmental and energy. We did a lot of work for ABC, I happened to do a fair amount of work for ABC News, FOIA litigation and that kind of thing. So it was interesting.
Did you start doing a lot of trial work at that point?
I was involved in several trials. It was a litigation firm, so, most large cases don't go to trial that much, but I was involved in several trials there and, lots of depositions and litigation. Very, very good law firm became a partner there. So right around the time that President Reagan became president and antitrust started to dry up. So I became a partner and immediately got a cut in pay. The firm eventually sort of dissolved or it was not, sort of a bankruptcy or anything. Just the business had changed. So having been a partner just a few years, I ended up learning a lot about the tax laws because I recaptured all the depreciation I never got on things. So I was there for, I guess, about 10 years.
Okay.
I was there from about 1976 to 1986.
So what took you to the SEC?
Well, that's an interesting question. The firm, we decided to disband. There were people going to other antitrust firms. I liked antitrust law, you know, very much. You sort of delve into the ins and outs of a particular business. You know, I did work for Frito-Lay, and I learned all about, you know, the salty snack market and, you know, other industries. But I thought, you know, going to the government would be interesting. And I remember somebody telling me that the trial unit in the enforcement department was looking for lawyers, and somebody I think who knew Tom Newkirk, who was the head of the trial group at that point, and I said this sounded interesting, so I went there and met Tom. I think the trial group numbered all of about 8 people at that point in time, and interviewed with Tom, and it just sounded, you know, exciting and different, and so I decided, well, it's a good time for change, accepted an offer and started there.
Now, this is in the general counsel's office.
This is in enforcement, in the enforcement department.
Right. Okay. Who was head of enforcement at that point?
Gary Lynch.
Okay. Did you talk to him too?
I met him briefly. Interviewed with Tom and several of the other people in the group, and again, it was a fairly small group at that point in time.
So how did they bring you into things? How did they sort of season you and make you an SEC guy?
Well, a legend, which should go down in the annals of the SEC, could not have this interview without talking about that, is I was going from a law firm. It wasn't a fancy law firm, but you know, we had nice offices, and so my office was an interior office. It was actually large. I think there were 2 or 3 paralegals in there, but the walls were all marked up from boxes and everything like that. So when I got the office, somehow I got in touch with the office manager and said, "Could I get the office painted before I come in?" And he said, he sort of laughed and said, "No, but you know, you can go ahead and paint it." And he mentioned somebody who was there a long time. Al Rush had just painted his office, and he can tell you what color paint or whatever. So I said, "Fine." So I spoke to Al and got the paint, and never did a lot of painting. But my wife and I came in the Sunday before I was going to start. We brought in a ladder and we brought in the paint, painted the office, and started on Monday, went down to get fingerprinted, and they show you films, and I came back to the office, and on the desk was one of the, at that point, I'm sure they don't have them anymore, but there were these yellow message slips that the government had that said, "Call so-and-so." So I remember standing there, picked up the phone, calling this person. I didn't even sit down. It was somebody in facilities, and they said, "We know you painted your office this weekend. We have the masking tape as evidence." And he said, "Turn around." And I turned around, and I had this radio, an old tube radio that I bought at a flea market that I, you know, would listen maybe to World Series games or something on. And he said, "We should have confiscated that radio and sent it to GSA to see if it was a fire hazard. We are going to have to repaint your office and bill you for it $200 and some odd. And, you know, I thought like I was going to be fired and, you know, go to jail. And I went in and spoke to Tom, and he sort of laughed and spoke to Gary. And, you know, lo and behold, a few days later, somebody did come in and repaint the office. And, you know, I heard rumblings about it for months. And then I eventually found out that the office manager, a guy by the name of Tom Rogers, who told me I could do it, they sort of blamed him, and they ended up settling for like $90. And Tom had to, this was, I think Tom had left by then, Tom had to pay that money. But apparently there was some regulation, I don't know, maybe it was a private building and a union issue or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the Washington Post, and I think it's in some book, did the story about, you know, how somebody, you know, it's sort of a government type of story. You
oh, that's true.
You know, pay for the paint and do it, and then they bill you to repaint it. So that was my sort of introduction, you know, to the government.
So you learned about doing things according to the book, I guess, after that.
Yeah, meeting. Yeah. I to Tom and Gary's credit, I guess they didn't, I was new, they didn't want me to deal with it, so they sort of shielded me from the, the controversy. But,
yeah.
It was pretty funny.
And I suppose that was one of the easier things to deal with that they had to worry about at that point.
Anyway. Yeah. I started there, I believe, in April or March of 86. And I was very fortunate because when I got there, I had nothing on my plate, and they assigned me to the Dennis Levine insider trading case, which led to the Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken cases. So my first assignment there was, you know, at that time, you know, probably the largest insider trading case ever.
Right.
And I, you know, sort of got the benefit of everybody else's work.
Right.
And got involved in that, which was, coming from doing antitrust with lots of documents and papers, this was, you know, like a movie. It was pretty amazing.
How far had that case gone along when you came in?
It was, for some reason, I think it was filed like the 14th of April or something. It was probably within a matter of a week or 10 days from being filed. So it was essentially done.
Okay.
That was the first case that I worked on. And, there was a number of staff lawyers who sort of broke the case. I think there was a little resentment sort of coming in at the end for all the fun.
Get in the pictures and stuff.
But, you know, it was, you know, press and stories and front page news and, it was pretty interesting, and we were at the U.S. Attorney's office.
What kind of work were you doing as part of this team?
Helping to draft the complaint, the case was litigated a little bit, and John Stirk, who's a partner of mine here now, sort of was handling the in-court. Some of the in-court litigation as it went forward. And, I think my sort of major work really was to, deal with, once Dennis Levine cooperated, to sort of deal with him and other people who ended up cooperating and interviewing. We were working primarily with Peter Sonnenthal.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent many, many days sort of interviewing Dennis Levine and Robert Wilkes and sort of the people in that ring. And then that case was built, and then the Boesky case was filed, and, I drafted, that complaint, and then Milken, and was sort of in charge of that set of litigation. Most of which settled eventually, and we negotiated, there's a whole litany of, it's a $100 million case with Boesky, and then I can't remember what Drexel settled for, and then Michael Milken, and everything sort of settled except for a case against the Posners, which I actually tried in New York before Judge Pollack, and we won that case. It was a remarkable series of cases because of the dollars involved, the people involved, and, the Milken cases, a lot of very intense negotiations with, you know, his lawyer, Arthur Lyman, and,
right.
You know, it spanned a number of chairmen. So it was just a, you know, incredible series of cases.
Tell me about this team that you're on. Was it a fairly coherent group that followed these people from one to the other?
Yeah, I mean, there were sort of people who came in and out at different stages, but, you know, there was sort of a, you know, a core group, and, you know, John Stirk had been very much involved until he left. You know, on the Milken stuff, I think by that time, Bill McLucas had become head of enforcement, so Bill was involved. But, you know, in terms of staff lawyers, you know, Peter Sonnenthal was very much involved. Leo Wang, Terry Pritchard in some things. Tom Newkirk had been involved. But I was sort of the lead litigator. I remember in the Dennis Levine case, we tried to get the money that we collected to go back to investors. And the IRS came in and said, no, we want the money. So we were litigating against the IRS in court, which was sort of odd. But a couple of anecdotes, I mean, that I remember. I remember going up to New York on, this was days after I started, and I think it was sort of Dennis Levine had said he was going to cooperate, and we were in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the head of the securities group, the U.S. Attorney's Office, Charlie Carberry, who is a sort of a legend. I mean, he's a big, big guy, and they probably still have the desk. There was the head of the securities group had this, you know, humongous old government desk, and I remember Levine sort of coming in and, quote, cooperating, and Carberry sort of just saying, you know, that's not going to do, you know, and leaning over the table, you know, and I'm sitting there taking notes, and, you know, we spent that Sunday, and I remember taking, this was before the Metroliner, I think, but I remember taking the last train back. It was like a night sleeper train, and I was in like a little compartment, and I sort of, you know, wrote down my notes and my mental impressions, and, you know, I'll sort of remember that. I also remember in the Boesky case, he paid $50 million in cash and then $50 million in securities. And I remember being downtown. I mean, they just handed us these securities. And I'm like walking around with a trench coat. I remember with Peter, you know, carrying under my coat $50 million. And I don't know if they were negotiable securities or not. You know, so I remember that. I remember the day we filed the Dennis Levine case, we went up to Drexel and sort of met with the firm, and they had their annual report with a picture of Dennis Levine in it. And the next day we went back and all the reports were gone. And then a couple weeks later they reissued the report without Dennis Levine. So, and, you know, we got to, you know, sort of know Levine and you know, Boesky too. There was a lot of debriefing and, you know, a lot of these other people. So it was sort of interesting to sort of get to know them as people.
Did you work with Michael Milken on that?
Yeah, I mean, we, Milken, you know, ostensibly cooperated, but didn't, you know, and really, you know, would not say anything bad about any of his people, essentially. But we did, and this was after Milken was sentenced and actually in jail. I went out to someplace east of San Francisco and interviewed him in jail about something. And visiting him in jail was quite something. I remember he had worn a toupee throughout this, but he doesn't wear one now, but in jail I guess you're not allowed to. So sort of speculating what's he going to look like without the toupee, but he was didn't want me to have any any pleasure, so he wore a baseball cap through the whole the whole thing. But I remember seeing him in jail, and you know, the sort of these this notion of these, you know, white collar country club prisons, well, you know, was really far. I mean, certainly a lot better than a medium security prison, but that was interesting. I also remember a funny story when I think I was with Peter, and this was when Dennis Levine was in jail, and he was in Lewisburg, and it was sort of the end of his jail time, and he had gotten a lot of harassment in jail for being sort of a stool pigeon and, you know, like dead rats in his bed and that kind of thing. So every time he spoke to the government, something would happen to him, so he was very, very nervous, you know, didn't like to do it because there'd be something would happen in jail. So they developed this thing where he would go to the infirmary and he would, you know, they would take him out the door through there. And we went to sort of it was like a Red Lion Inn, you know, like a motel in mm-hmm. Lewisburg, and the marshals were there with him and we would interview him. So they would go through this whole elaborate thing. And we walk into the lobby. In those days, they didn't have electronic, you know, message boards. They had these felt boards with the letters, and it said, you know, Dennis Levine, ambassador room, or something like that. So, like, everybody, you know, knew he was there. So it was that was pretty interesting.
This was a period of a few years, I guess, that this thing unfolded.
Yeah, I mean, Levine was 86. You know, Boesky was a couple of years later.
Right.
And then Milken, and then the Posner trial that I did was a few years later. Interspersed with this was this global settlement where, growing out of Drexel's bankruptcy, where all of the class actions, all the cases against Milken, all the cases against Drexel, Judge Pollack in New York engineered this massive, I don't remember what the number was, but billions, I can't even remember. And I was involved in that, and that was quite interesting. I got to know Judge Pollack very, very well. We were pretty close, you know, for many years after that. Also because they tried to kick him off the case.
Which case was
this
that?
This was the Drexel, the Milken case.
Okay. Yeah, I remember something about it. It appeared that he was the judge that the SEC would prefer.
Well, yeah, these stories are great, but we, it was this sort of long investigation and negotiation, and then, you know, the case didn't settle, so the case was filed in federal court, and we filed it as a related case to another case that Judge Pollack had. We thought Judge Pollack would be a good judge, and for, you know, they must have been tapping the phones or watching, you know, with cameras. They knew we were filing, so we went to the clerk's office to file the case, and lo and behold, the defense lawyers were there, and we had there was a paralegal, a woman, I can't remember her name, in New York, who sort of did all the filings, and they knew how to do it, so we're in the clerk's office with her, and Tom Newkirk was there, and the lawyer representing Lowell Milken, Michael Armstrong, is there. Tom, we go to file it, and there's this sort of shoving match at the clerk's window. We're trying to file it as a related case, and they didn't want it, and they're pushing us away, and sort of this pushing back and forth, and one of the, Marty Flumenbaum, one of the lawyers from Milken, started yelling at me that, you know, file Rule 11 sanctions against you if you file it to Judge Pollack, and so there's all this hubbub in the clerk's office, and then, I don't know, the judge knew we were filing it and sends his clerk down and motions us over and takes us up the judge's elevator to give him the papers. And then, lo and behold, you know, we filed that on a Thursday or Friday or Saturday. I can't remember, Thursday or Friday. A couple of days later, we hear, we just learned that Judge Pollack's wife, her family owned a number of stores, Palais Royal, in Texas, and we just learned that Drexel is doing an LBO, and gee, we're sorry, you know, the judge is going to have to recuse himself. The judge went nuts over this. We defended the judge. It turned out in a very divided court of appeals. Eventually, that he kept the case, and you know, the reason I think was there was always this sort of smell that this was a setup, and the sort of the fighting in the clerk's office, I think, colored some of the judges mm-hmm. on the Court of Appeals' perceptions that they were playing games here. You know, I think they had a pretty strong case for getting him off. Right. So he stayed on, and since I was the one defending the judge, and the judge took this very personally, he, you know, we became sort of close, and you know, so.
You're defending the judge, although you're a lawyer for the SEC.
Right. Well, they filed a motion to recuse him in the district court, and okay. we said there's no basis.
Okay.
He should stay on the case, which he agreed, obviously.
Yeah. So you're moving through these legendary cases, and there's obviously the little idiosyncrasies and things. But with you've got this team of people. I'm wondering what did you learn over this period of time? What were the things that you realized when you'd gone through all this that things had really changed and you were doing things differently somehow?
You know, I think the SEC always brought big cases, but you know, these, you know, for people who sort of have this in their blood, I mean, it's just very invigorating to, you know, deal with, you know, significant, substantial cases involving, you know, what we believe was, you know, clear wrongdoing. You know, in terms of sort of motivating people, you know, and people like to read about their cases in the newspapers and that kind of thing, but you know, there's really an enormous amount of satisfaction, you know, in doing that. And you know, these cases, you know, are not made with, you know, in the trial in the courtroom. I mean, these are mm-hmm. cases, and particularly the Levine case. You know, the people who worked on that case. You know, there were foreign bank issues, and you know, they stuck with it and broke the case. And you know, that is sort of where I think the real work and the good work at the SEC is done. And you know, people who can you know, amass facts and develop facts and develop evidence, you know. And, you know, it's sometimes you have a cooperator who walks in the door. It's pretty easy. Not that easy, but it's easier. But, you know, these cases sort of, it started with an anonymous letter, you know, but leading to how they developed right. that. And then there have been books written about that.
Yes, there
So, you know, that's you know, pretty amazing stuff.
So you moved through those cases. You mentioned a little bit about the Posner case. There was also some stock parking cases.
Yeah, interesting case. It was a case against the Bellsberg company. They were a very wealthy Canadian family. Label that people put on them were green mailers. You know, they would acquire a stake in company and then sort of demand that they be bought out and make a lot of money. But it was a case involving Mark Bellsberg and the company, and it was the first litigated 13D case. And you know, it was an interesting case. Ace Greenberg was involved. He was not named, although was very close to being named. We tried that here in D.C., and the lawyer on the other side was Arthur Lyman, who had just been sort of finishing up Iran-Contra. So, you know, going up against sort of a legend, you know, it was pretty, pretty intense, pretty interesting. And I remember the closing arguments. There, Arthur was analogizing her case to Alice in Wonderland, and there was an Esquire article. It was a profile of Arthur Lyman, and it came out before the judge had ruled. But they basically said, you know, I was just sort of, you know, limp against the wall, just, you know, amazed by this guy's oratory. And then we, of course, won the case and won the appeal. So, that was a good case, and really significant case as well.
Was the stock parking kind of new as far as something that was recognized?
I think I'm not sure there were a lot of. I think there were other 13D cases, but not too many parking cases. I think it was clearly the first litigated case. I think it wasn't groundbreaking law. The question really turned on being able to prove the facts, and it was circumstantial, and we did pretty well. I remember Harry Weiss had worked on that case as a staff lawyer, and was involved in the trial, and Leo Ornstein, who just a fabulous, fabulous writer, significantly contributed, to that case as well.
So in 93, you became chief litigation counsel. That's what I've got anyway.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the setup at that point. How many people have you got working for you? Is there some kind of organization that you're
I think I'm just guessing, I mean, maybe we had 16 or 17 people. I mean, the unit had, when I joined, was 7 or 8, so it was large. And the challenge, and it's probably still the challenge, even though the unit's much larger, is the way it was structured. Once a case got into litigation, it was handled by the trial group, but theoretically, you had the staff who developed the case working with you from the branches, and there was always this tension because the supervisors in the branches wanted to develop new cases and use their people to investigate. And of course, when you get involved in litigation, it's sort of day and night, and you can't do too much more. So you would always have these, some of the associate directors were better than others in sort of giving up their people, and oftentimes you had these fabulous staff attorneys who were critical to your case that you're litigating. On the other side, they're trying to develop new cases, so you would negotiate, and, it was a little tense. It wasn't as if the trial group sort of had senior lawyers and junior lawyers who did that. Plus, you needed the expertise, the people on the case. So
you're negotiating resources with other people.
Right, right, other sort of challenges, which, we had a terrific general counsel's office, Paul Gonson, Jake Stillman, and others. But it always seemed that, you win a case, and then the general counsel's office gets it, and they're saying, well, what about this, and what about that, and, gee, I don't see this. This is a problem. And you sort of educate them, and then pretty soon, they're gung-ho on the case. So that was always fun. And, we had some interesting appeals. The Bellsberg case was appealed. I think Eric Sommergrad did that. Might have been Paul Gonson. The Pollock recusal case was appealed, and I remember Paul Gonson did that. And, that was a lot of fun.
So if it gets appealed, it goes to the general counsel's
office. Right, right. So they handled it. But, of course, you work with it. And then the Posner case was also appealed, and I think Paul handled that. And on the other side who was the guy from Pepperdine who was, I guess, in the Bush or Reagan what's his name? Yeah. Right? The very, very conservative lawyer. Is it Sidley and Austin?
It's escaping me.
Yeah. He argued Ken... I can't remember his name. Ken... Anyway, he was sort of a... Ken Starr, the guy who did the Clinton.
Yeah.
Ken Starr was defending the Posners.
Okay.
And those appeals were fun. I mean, I didn't handle them, of course, but sort of
maybe that
rooting them
fun.
On. Yeah.
I mean, there must have been a sense of carrying a lot on your shoulders when you were handling the cases.
The significant cases, I think there are a lot of other cases, in a sense, having cooperating witnesses and stuff helps, the cases that are really hard, are the ones that, the circumstantial insider trading cases where, you don't have somebody up there saying they did it.
And, right.
Those cases, the trial group had a lot of, and those were difficult cases. There were a lot of cases that were in the group that I, didn't handle directly. The Crazy Eddie case. There were just a lot of interesting, cases that people did.
Because of this struggle for resources or the negotiations,
right.
Did you ever hit a point where you said, "Well, we just can't pursue that one because it's just." It's not clear that we're going to get anywhere with it.
I'm sure that cases, were dropped or settled. I don't think it was ever really a resource issue. I mean, some of the cases turned out to go on for a very long time. The first Jersey case, I remember, which we won, won for a long time. But, we always managed to get things done. I think, some of the litigation now that in some of the cases I think are probably more complex and more resource intensive today. Of course, the trial group is bigger, the SEC is bigger, but I think the big challenge for the commission is they bring more cases and more cases are not settling, is to be able to have the resources because, The joke would be, somebody, a defendant who has insurance or their company's backing them, have, an unlimited budget and they've exceeded it. Being on this side now, I can see that. Although, their unlimited budgets don't exist anymore.
Either, yeah. So. Well, let's take you into NASD. The decision to make the jump over there and. And I want to get a sense of how the skills overlapped. I mean, was there a learning curve?
Yeah, I mean, there was Mary Shapiro went over there the NASD, they had the 21A report.
Right.
And Elise Walter. And, I was at the SEC sort of, I'm doing this. Didn't really want to go into private practice that much, and I remember reading something in the journal that they were, either looking for a head of enforcement or something. So, the NASD, based on my job, I think I had two contacts with them in all my career. So I sort of knew what they did, but I really didn't. But then I said, Mary's really good, and this is a way to do something else, and, there's a lot of changes. So I went over there and spoke to Mary, but, I didn't understand very much about sort of, the NASD rules and disciplinary process, and, of course, everything was in flux then. I went over there, and, they were very interested, so... So I did it, I sort of walked into they don't go to federal court, and at that point the disciplinary process was all being revamped. You know, these sort of obscure rules that I really didn't deal with, what do they mean, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was very different. The job was different because, you know, it was basically building an enforcement program from the ground up, you know, not litigating cases. So,
right.
You know,
did you just kind of sit down and try to learn about the NASD and figure out how it was structured?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit, but it was more sort of, you know, learning on the job. And there were a lot of issues coming in because there hadn't really been – there was a small enforcement department in Washington called the Enforcement Department, and then the rest of the lawyers were – part of the regional offices and reported into the directors of those offices. And what we did was we took those lawyers and had them reporting into me. And many of those people were the more experienced senior people, very close to the directors. So it was several years before, you know, sort of people were on the same team. It was there was a lot of resistance, you know, to basically, you know, people running district offices losing authority over, you know, sometimes their closest advisors and lawyers.
It had been a decentralized sort of organization.
Right, right. There was a small group in Washington that did cases. There was a group in market surveillance, market regulation that did cases, but the bulk of the cases were done, you know, in the district offices. So there was not a sort of one enforcement department, and you know, getting the district directors on board, and even getting the lawyers on board. You know, who's this guy coming in? He's not here. He's not in Chicago or New York. So it took, you know, it really took, you know, 4 or 5 years before, you know, things were, you know, I think people were sort of coming from the same page, and you know, that was challenging.
How much of what you did was sort of prescribed by the 21A report or by the Redmond Commission report?
I mean, the disciplinary code and the governance that was set up was, you know, and there was a sort of a special monitor in place for a number of years. He had certain reports and talked to him. So I think the structure was, but, you know, not so much the day-to-day work. We were, you know, obviously very sensitive to bringing cases and doing things in the areas where there were sort of the lapses that were identified.
Such as?
I mean, there was, you know, collusion, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I remember there were some follow-up cases that we investigated. When I came in, sort of the big cases that were going on continued to go on were the sort of the boiler room penny stock cases. There was a policy in place that I thought was nuts, was that if you file a complaint, the complaint is not public and you can't publicize it until you get a final adjudication on it. So, you know, you would file a case against, you know, Stratton Oakmont or, you know, some of these boiler rooms, and they continue to do business. Investors didn't even know that you had allegations out there. So that was changed. You know, we ended up focusing a lot of the efforts on a lot of the big sort of the penny stock cases and, mm-hmm. you know, doing some pretty good work getting those out. And those were sort of in place, but I think the additional resources. I remember part of the 21A was that the NASD had to spend, you know, X million dollars on enforcement, and so right. I was a beneficiary of that. So I think there were 30 people when I got there. When I left, there were over 200 in enforcement. So, you know, we built up staff and resources, and so. But it was a very different process, very different rules, and I think it took a little while to sort of realize, in a sense, sometimes you could do more with those rules because some of those rules were pretty, you know, like Rule 2110, just and equitable principles of trade, high ethical standards. So that's a lot easier to prove than, you know, a violation of 10b-5. So some of the NASD rules were a lot more flexible, in a sense, fit some of the, you know, the bad conduct that we were saying.
One of the early principles of the self-regulating or regulatory organization is this idea of upholding moral ethical standards.
Yeah. I think over time we saw, you know, even in the cases involving research analysts and you know, spinning, laddering, some of these practices, I think there's a lot of wisdom to that because, you know, it may not be 10b-5, it may not be fraud, you know, but it's unethical, it's wrong, it's bad. And some of the NASD rules, you know, the gift and gratuities rule, you know, which is a pretty simple rule. It's a little nuts sometimes, but...
Why is it nuts?
Well, I mean, it says you can't give anybody, a firm can't give someone a gift of more than $100 a year if the gift was made sort of in relation to the business. So you look at the cases involving, I don't know if you remember the Dwarf case, that there were a bunch of Fidelity traders there was a guy at Jefferies who, in order to get business, trading business through Jefferies, was taking people on vacations. There were allegations of, you know, drugs and prostitutes. And also there was a bachelor party where they hired a dwarf to entertain. But, you know, does that violate 10b-5? I mean, I'm not sure, but it would violate the gift rule. So,
okay.
You know, the some of the research analyst cases where there were some fraud cases, but a lot of those cases were brought under the NASD's advertising rules, which covers research that wasn't fair and balanced. You know, you might not be able to prove that it was intentionally false or there was scienter. So, you know, there's a lot more flexibility to cover, you know, sort of a wider range of market conduct where federal securities laws may not cover. So,
right.
You know, I think we're pretty effective, you know, in doing that.
So you've got a lot more room to sort of to bring action against people.
Right.
As far as penalties, what was the range there?
Well, the you know, you can get fines, you can get suspensions, and you can bar people from the industry. So in some sense, you know, if you want to work in the securities industry, the remedies the SEC that you can do at FINRA or the NASD are just as good or better. One remedy we didn't have, we put in place, we used it very sparingly, was a sort of a emergency temporary cease and desist order, like a TRO. There was no ability, other than sort of financial, you know, the firm was in financial trouble, but to stop ongoing conduct. Unfortunately, you know, it was a cumbersome process. You know, it was better suited for federal court, so people were reluctant to use it. We used it a few times, but that was something that the industry just went crazy about. We got it approved. It wasn't used that much. But, you know, the SEC had a much easier job because you can go to court and get an asset freeze or a TRO.
Right.
To pretty easy, well-worn process. It was difficult at the NASD. The NASD did have the ability, still does, that if you don't cooperate, they can bar you from the industry. So if somebody comes in and takes the fifth, you theoretically, and they do this a lot, can bar someone. That was challenged a lot. It's still, you know, people have chipped away at it. But whereas at the SEC, somebody could come in and say, look, I'm subject to a criminal investigation, I'm going to take the fifth. You know, you can get an adverse inference in court or whatever, but you can't, throw them out.
Right. So again, you've got this greater area that you can work with,
right,
in the SRO.
Right.
Something else that caused a lot of uproar was this criminal prosecution assistance group.
Yeah.
Tell me about where the idea came from for that.
It was called CPAG, and I think it's, you know, sort of a lot to do about nothing. One thing the NASD, I think, has, and I think Mary is clearly moving the SEC more towards it, is the NASD historically was not, even the enforcement process, was not lawyer-oriented. You have a lot of analysts, you have people from the industry who are not lawyers, who are very good at analyzing trading records and what have you. So the idea for CPAG was Bruce Bettegol, who worked with me actually at my law firm. I worked with him at the SEC and sort of brought him in to the NASD. And Bruce always sort of liked the criminal end of it. But, you know, there are a lot of prosecutors around the country who, you know, get a securities case, you know, and never tried one. They don't have people who can put together exhibits or explain trading or explain phenomena. So we put together this group in enforcement to not, you know, investigate criminal cases, but to provide assistance to prosecutors either as expert witnesses or helping to put together charts or, you know, looking at evidence, that kind of thing. And it was a very small group. it was, there were a couple of cases where, you know, sort of the idea of the NASD being a state actor has always been an issue.
Right.
Sort of another arm of the government. So, you know, there was a case where actually somebody challenged that, we won the case. But, you know, there was always this sort of, you know, why are you doing criminal work? You're an industry organization. So there was a lot of, you know, sort of hubbub about that. It was in enforcement, so I think that eventually got transferred to the general counsel's office.
That was Cromwell Investment?
Yeah, that was before Judge Kaplan. And, you know, there was, you know, the case was, we won the case, you know, but there was an evidentiary hearing, so people got very nervous about it. In fact, I think my law firm now, I think, was involved in that, assisting the NASD.
What were you nervous about?
Well, people were always nervous about being called a state actor.
Right.
And if you're a state actor, that brings into play a whole bunch of, you know, limitations. Particularly, I think, you know, if somebody takes the fifth, then you can't throw them out of the industry. So people sort of, you know, have challenged that over the years, and the
right.
case law, I think, has been, you know, pretty good. But I think CPAG got people a little nervous because they were working with the government. You know, I don't think that makes them a state actor. So that was, you know. But, you know, if you talk to the prosecutors, you know, this group, I think, provided really important assistance, you know, in you know, it would be like, you know, sort of the government going out and hiring sort of a expert in trading to explain things to them.
And, right.
And, you know, and I think there were a number of, you know, cases with very bad conduct that this group, you know, helped enormously.
Well, there are those who argue that NASD was a state actor, and then, but on the other hand, you know, how much of an industry representative was NASD? I mean, the members, you know, would the members really sort of relate themselves to enforcement, or would they say, "Oh, here come to you guys again"? You know,
no, they certainly didn't. I think the you know, one thing in this enforcement, there's a pendulum, and I think that you know, the 21A. I mean, one of the criticisms was this was you know an old boy network, and you know that you know, the organization did not have enough independence from the industry. It was dominated by the industry. You know, so there were all these governance changes about having non-industry board members and on the NAC having a balance. You know, the disciplinary process, it was a very sort of insular kind of process where people in enforcement would go to the district committee and sort of present their case, you know, get authorized, and then the district committee would hear the case. And there was a feeling that, you know, certain kinds of cases wouldn't get authorized, and that, you know, there were competitive issues having, you know, sort of the industry so enmeshed in the disciplinary process. So part of the 21A was to, you know, try to give more independence to the NASD, and you know, there was enormous pushback for years, and probably still is, that you know, we're no longer a membership organization. You don't care what we say. You know, you're just like the SEC. So, you know, I think by design there was this independence. Now, the question is, well, you know, did the industry still have a meaningful role? And I think Mary's challenge, and I think she did an excellent job of, you know, getting input from the industry on rule changes, processes, and making sure that rules work, because they don't always affect big firms and small firms the same way. And, you know, having people who are dealing with these on a day-to-day basis come in and say, you know, you really need to change this because it's just – it's not going to work. It's not going to get to where you want, or it's just going to cost the industry, you know, a waste of money because it could be done this way. So, you know, I think over time the industry sort of realized, okay, well, this is not the old NASD. Now I think things have sort of shifted back a little bit. I think, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, I think the enforcement has sort of been dialed back a little bit in some of the cases, but it's, you know, it's certainly, by virtue of the 21A, it's not a trade association.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the view, at least of the SEC, was it was, you know, it wasn't doing its job. So striking that balance between getting industry input, which is extremely valuable, you know, the hearings are still one hearing officer and two people from the industry. There are industry people, obviously, on the board, industry people on the NAC, the appellate body. So there is still a lot of industry input, but it's certainly not dominated, particularly in the disciplinary process. So to answer your question, you know, we were never welcome, you know. I mean, I think they'd probably rather see us than the SEC or the Justice Department, but you know, enforcement. You know, there was a lot of criticism and pushback, and there, you know, there still is.
And you talked about bringing the members in on the input on the front end. As far as you, though, enforcement being sort of on the back end of the process, was there ever any consideration about, you know, doing things differently in order to hold the membership together? Or
no, I mean, the our investigations, you know, I mean, there were times when people would pick up the phone and, you know, call Mary or Bob Glauber, and, you know, to their credit, you know, I mean, sometimes there'd be a meeting or something and we would attend or what have you, but, you know, I can't think of one instance where somebody would say, gee, I got a call from, you know, I'll use Bear Stearns as an example.
Yeah, they're, no, they're safe. Around.
But, you know, from the, you know, the chairman of Bear Stearns saying, you guys are all over this and, you know, I want you to stop this. Those calls did come in. But, you know, and I remember some to Bob Glauber, and he said, you know, well, talk to Mary. I'm not involved. And Mary would listen and, you know, maybe relay something, but there was never, you know, sort of pressure, you know, to go a certain way. I mean, they were sort of, you know, look, the industry is very upset about this. You know, did you consider X, Y, and Z sort of generally? And, you know, that was fine, but never, you know, shut down this investigation or anything like that.
Okay. Well, moving from those sort of conceptual type things back into some of the specifics, you talked about the penny stock issue, which was seemed to be pretty big in the late 90s, around 2000 or so. And then day trading came in as well.
Yeah, I mean, there was penny stocks, there was day trading, which, you know, seized everybody's imagination. And, you know, we brought some cases.
Now that would be one where you'd have a lot of people on your side.
Yeah, other than the day traders, you know, the firms, you know, it was, I think, more of a phenomenon. You know, if you look at, you know, to me, it was more of a, looking back on, I mean, given the realm of bad things that could happen, you know, it was more of a, sort of a, you're sort of advertising kind of thing. You're enticing people to, you know, exaggerating claims of success and that kind of thing. So, you know, school teachers giving up their jobs and becoming day traders, you know, and losing all their money. So, you know, that I think was fairly short-lived. You know, there was penny stocks. There was, you know, the mob on Wall Street, which sort of had a few cycles of you know, bad people infiltrating small firms. You know, that was a phenomenon as well.
How much of your office's time did things like that involve, those sort of special issues that came up?
Well, I think there was a you know, I think you see it today, that enforcement people do respond to press. And, you know, I remember the there was all this to do with, you think about it, the E-Trade ads of the tow truck driver who says, you know, I used to drive this tow truck and now I'm, you know, trading online and, you know, I don't see that island over there, I own it, you know. And like people saying, whoa, that's, you know, something should be done about that, you know. Of course, everybody would look at it. But I think you do respond to sort of what might be in the news or current. You've seen that today, obviously, and stuff. But so, you know, the research analyst issues were huge. You know, everybody sort of credits Elliot Spitzer with sort of exposing that. And the NASD had ongoing investigations at the time of, you know, Spitzer. But that was a, you know, all of the tech bubble bursting and Frank Quattrone and, you know, spinning and hot IPOs, that was a, you know, sort of a big issue for the NASD.
Right. Yeah, IPO allocation practices,
right.
I guess people,
right.
And that's what Quattrone was doing.
Well, if that's, Quattrone said he wasn't, but it started out, in fact, a book just came out, a very good book by Randy Smith on Quattrone, The Prince of Silicon Valley, which sort of looks at it in perspective. But it started off with the IPO allocation practices. There was an anonymous letter. They went to a bunch of regulators. We jumped on it, and basically, hot IPOs being allocated to people who would then do very large volume trades in liquid securities, where the commissions would normally be 5 or 6 cents a share, and they'd pay 50 cents or $1 a share, sort of paying back for the IPOs. So there was that, and then there was research analyst problems, and then spinning the Friends of Frank, where IPOs would be allocated to people who would be in a position to direct banking business. So those were all very, very big issues.
Did you assemble teams? Did you have a task force to go?
I can't remember what we called it, but at some point we developed these rapid response teams where basically you would sort of pool a lot of resources to deal with an issue. We did that. We also started a sort of a preliminary review group, which I thought was very effective, where, the way it used to work is something would come in and you'd assign it to an investigative group and somebody would spend 2 months on it and realize there was nothing there. So this was sort of a triage group we did, and that was useful. There would be sort of larger groups of people put together to look at a specific issue. There would be sweeps. We would, go out to, and that's been pretty standard.
Like boiler room type stuff. So.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a, day trading, I think, we would identify a bunch of day trading firms and then go out and get certain information, and then from that sort of say, okay, here is a bunch of firms that could be engaging in the practices we're concerned about, and then start to investigate. But that's something, the SEC does, a lot of regulators do. So. Mm.
The research analyst issue, I mean, at heart it's the idea that the brokers are, sort of booming their own stocks. And when you're talking about going after that and what happened, I mean, it's a pretty draconian sort of solution, is saying you're either going to sell stocks or you're going to be an analyst, right? Was that, if you were starting to move into that, I would suppose that would have been a pretty big deal, given how fundamental the change
was
likely to be.
The issue was whether research was independent and
right.
unbiased, and the problem really was the structure that research was really part of banking at a lot of firms, and
right.
compensation was based on how successful the bankers were, and the research analysts would be essentially salesmen, or salespersons who would,
right.
When you go on a pitch, you say, we have so-and-so as an analyst, and you bring the analyst and, sort of a promise of favorable research, and then, of course, the emails where an analyst says something, is a piece of shit, and the firm has a strong buy on it, and that was, the NASD had advertising rules that covered research at the time. There were a lot of tools to address specific problems. What happened was, Elliot Spitzer came out with the Blodgett case and Merrill Lynch started saying the SEC was asleep at the switch and FINRA or the NASD was, and the regulators sort of felt threatened, and Spitzer was out there. Everything was public. He did his investigations in the press. There was this whole move to do something about this. The tech bubble burst. So you ended up having 50 states, the SEC, the NASD, maybe some criminal people, all looking at the same thing and, culminating in what was called the global settlement against, 8 or 10 firms.
Right.
And out of that, research and banking, the relationship was restructured as part of an enforcement case. And I always felt the way to do that is through rule changes, And I think we were a moderating force in that. But, you know, you had a lot of people who sort of didn't really understand what was going on, you know, in the industry, you know, coming up with, well, you know, you need a chaperone here and you can do it there. You know, it was sort of an odd way of sort of changing the entire relationship. And I think it turned out okay. I think there were some people like Steve Cutler involved who really understood it. And I think Mary, you know, was a force for, you know, trying to get it right.
So in this case, it sounds like NASD and enforcement or NASD reg would have been sort of representing the interests of the members in trying to moderate the
process. Well, I think there was a frenzy out there of enforcement, and we brought cases, and there were cases to bring. I guess our concern was, and, you know, as part of the global settlement, there was a document that basically said, well, if you're part of the settlement, 12 firms, this is how you have to, this is what you can do and can't do. And the question was, well, you know, there's 6,000, 5,000 firms out there or whatever. What about the rest of them? And, you know, we wanted, that was going to become the template. You know, I think we wanted something that would work. I don't think we were advocates for the industry, but, you know, we didn't want some settlement that would then become the standard somehow for everybody, and it wouldn't work. So I think that was a challenge. It was a very, you know, enforcement. You know, it's, again, the pendulum was swinging, the tech bubble burst, and people were left with, you know, portfolios. And, you know, after that, you could see the pendulum swinging back when people were saying, oh, we're driving capital abroad, we need to follow the FSA, principle-based regulation, too much regulation by enforcement.
Right.
Swung back, and then you had subprime, and now it's, you know, it's sort of swung off the clock. And
right.
So, you know, that's pretty much how it works.
Well, we talked about some of the big, you know, landmark things. But during this period where you're moving from, I don't know, you said 20 to 200 people in your...
Yeah,
your,
30 to 200
people. In addition to handling these big issues, what sorts of systematic things were being changed or beefed up or, you know, in the day-to-day, how were things developing over those years?
Well, we started a trial group, you know, I guess following the SEC model of a group of lawyers sort of brought in to handle the bigger litigation because, again, you know, the NASD, when I started, we were bringing 800 or 900 cases a year. We ended up going up to 1,400 some years. You know, fines went from, you know, a few million dollars, some years hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm. So... But, you know, you would get cases that were large cases that had to be litigated. So, you know, we started that. I brought in Rory Flynn, who was at the SEC, to sort of head that up. You know, it was a small group. So we did that, the sort of this preliminary review group that would be sort of a triage. You know, we had a big issue. Historically, the small enforcement group in Washington had, I said, we had a lot of analysts and accountants and non-lawyers, and then you had the lawyers. There were two chains of command. The non-lawyers reported up one way, the lawyers reported up another way, and, you know, they were supposed to work together. And for the most part, they did, but, you know, who's in charge? And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it was pretty much a legal process. You know, eventually those two chains did report up to lawyers. So at some point we sort of reorganized, had one chain, and we actually had, in some cases, lawyers reporting to non-lawyers who we felt were really good. So that was a big.
This is just in enforcement.
Right, in D.C. In the regional offices, we had the other problem of sort of the regional directors. There were, people who maybe were listening more to them than to us and that kind of thing. So, as you have turnover and old people who aren't used to the new way leave, things work pretty well. So that was, that was a big change. And then I think just, energizing people, the number of cases went up, the significance of the case, fines are at least one way of measuring that. I think became a much more relevant organization. There were some, the temporary cease and desist order we got, our ability to publicize complaints when they're filed was a big issue.
How long did it take for you to get that after 1996?
That came pretty quickly. I was just astonished that, and those cases could go on for years, and you still had, boiler rooms, right. Operating, and they were content. Well, nobody knows about the case. Right. This is crazy.
So this morale issue, I mean, some of this stuff sounds like what you must have experienced at the SEC during the 80s, where things, when you succeed, you build on the success.
Yeah, I mean, people do this business because they enjoy doing the big cases and the significant cases. So, when you become, more relevant and do these, and there were some cases, a lot of cases involving some really bad firms that, were put out of business. Stratton Oakmont was one of the worst. And I remember shortly after I got there, they came in, they were going to put people on their board that were these, I don't know where they got them from, how they convinced them to lend their names.
But
they wanted to say, let us still operate. And, we've turned the corner. And we said no, which is a good, but a lot of really bad firms got put out of business, by the NASD. And, a lot of criticism. It took too long. The NASD, I think, because of the 21A, there were, there's a lot of negative, the sort of the notion of the fox guarding the chicken. How in the world...
Right.
Could you police an industry when you're funded by the industry and you're an industry organization? So that sort of concept, that a lot of people believe.
It's the other side of the, you're a government entity, you're just the SEC argument.
People say, why just let the SEC do everything? That kind of thing.
One other angle is overlap with... such as with New York Stock Exchange, things like that. How much was that systematized? How much would you share notes or work together?
It was a problem, and everybody complains about regulatory duplication. And I think the global settlement, the research analyst was like just sort of a one-off because you had everybody looking at everything.
Right.
The NASD, is supervised by the SEC. There's oversight. So, at the end of the day, if the SEC says we want it, they generally got it. But I think it got better over time. I think when people are busy, you're more willing to defer. I think it's less of a problem than people thought. There were times when people felt our cases are being stolen from us.
By the SEC?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think by and large it was pretty good. Things would get divided. Sometimes, the SEC felt that they had to be there in a case, even though the NASD maybe was the one that investigated it, and so there'd be a joint kind of action. I don't think it was ever really the case where sort of the case was a $100 million fine, you know, that and the SEC wanted to be a part, so it was 50-50. It wasn't increased. So
how about the New York Stock Exchange? How much?
You know, there were issues on occasion, but I think the issues, if they were elevated up to the more senior people, they sort of got resolved. Problem would be where, you know, and this is part of the defense bar's problem, if you know you're being investigated by both, you know, raise your hand early on before the agency puts in 2 years of work, they're less likely to, you know, sort of disappear. So, you know, there were instances, but I think it's a problem that wasn't, you know, it arose from time to time.
Okay, but it wasn't, well, not an ongoing kind of a thing.
No.
All right. Well, that runs through everything I've got as far as the sort of landmarks of your time with NASD. Is there anything else that
No, I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, the I would say the, you know, the NASD when I joined it in 96 and then when I left, it enforcement grew and, you know, we brought a lot more cases and everything else. But, you know, where that organization was when I joined and where it ended up, you know, technology-wise, you know, governance-wise, you know, I remember, you know, what's now BrokerCheck, where you can go online and in, you know, 30 seconds get a broker's disciplinary history. Mm. You know, when I started there, I mean, I think you had to mail a letter and, you know, I mean, it was like, I mean, you know, the tools that the organization had, you know, just transformed. So I think a lot of that credit, you know, goes to Mary and Elise, you know, and some Linda Feinberg, I mean, the arbitration process. I do think, you know, self-regulatory, and we sort of changed, call ourselves a private sector regulator rather than a self-regulatory organization. There's just this sort of disbelief that you could do anything, you know, that's, you're not in the pocket of the industry.
That was a term that you used?
I think NASD changed, thought it more accurately described what we did. And quite frankly, the NASD does, there was still an effort to sort of do regulation for other markets. You know, the Chicago Climate Exchange, I don't know, we did something there. You know, foreign exchanges. So, you know, contracting out some of the technology and know-how. And then you get the, you know, there was a huge ongoing, you know, small firm, you know, the NASDs in the pockets of the big firms and, you know, these initiatives to sort of unseat the board and sue the NASD and, you know, you're too tough on the small firms and double standards. So, you know, just by definition, with such a diverse group, membership group, you know, the large firms would say, look, you know, you're charging us all this money and we don't have enough input. So you're really a target, you know, so.
That must have sorted itself out a good bit by the time you.
It would come and go, you know, but there would be, you know, lawsuits or threats to sort of have dissidents control the board and, you know, stuff like that. And it's a, you know, when you have 5,000 or 6,000 members, it's very difficult. So it's a, you know, it's a hard job, I think, to run that place because of, you know, just sort of all the criticism. I think the merger with the stock exchange, I mean, it's made a lot of sense, you know, and I think it's worked well.
Right. Was that in the air when you were still there? Was there any sense that was coming?
There was some talk. There was always some, you know, talk about it. I never thought it would happen. I really didn't.
What made it happen that you didn't anticipate?
It was you know, I had left sort of when it, you know, when it was happening. I really don't know. When you talk about duplication, I think I was talking more about enforcement. I think from the rule standpoint, it's probably a bigger issue because, you know, people had slightly different rules. So I probably underestimated that. I was talking more from enforcement. But, you know, I think you'd probably have to talk to the people who were there, you know, at the time, sort of what, you know, maybe... Maybe it was this sort of the pendulum was, you know, sort of we need more streamlined, efficient regulation, and it happened at that time. I'm not sure if we were in the middle of subprime crisis, you know, would have.
Did that factor at all into your decision to go into private practice?
No. I mean, I just sort of figured I had, you know, one more job left. I was getting old, you know, and... you know, the cases were good, but it was, you know, sort of the same job. So,
NASD regulation had been reinvented, and so you were sort of seeing the same things then at that.
Yeah. And, I mean, there was, I guess, at the time I left in March of 06, you know, the pendulum had swung sort of away from regulation, which... I mean, may have been a factor, just sort of saying, well, you know, it's sort of, well, this is sort of a slow time. that could have, you know, affected it. Now, of course, it's back. But
anything else we should
cover? No, I mean, I just have the highest regard, you know, for the commission, and you know the NASD as well, and I think the job, you know, Mary did and Elise did, you know, in really transforming what I think was a membership organization at a very hard time to something that really made a difference while keeping, you know, basically keeping the place together, you know, was pretty remarkable. And, you know, the commission is... you know, with all, you know, even on the private side, and you know, dealing sometimes with the state regulators are tough because there are so many of them and different. But you know, I think people in both groups, you know, try to be fair, and you know, I still have a lot of respect for, you know, what they do, and it's a hard job. You get blamed. I mean, the SEC, you know, I mean, there's valid criticism in areas, but, you know, something goes wrong.
Right.
You know, where were you?
Right.
And I don't think that'll ever change. You know, that comes with the territory.
All right. So. All right. Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
This was fun.